Good morning. My talk today is on the 10-year course of borderline personality disorder. Now, BPD is now seen as a valid disorder, and you might say, well, hasn't it always been? If you're young, that's true. If you're my age or older, that's not true. It was seen as a wastebasket term when I began my work as a graduate student with John Gunderson. But according to the criteria of Robbins and Guzet from 1970, BPD is valid because it has been proven to be delimited from other psychiatric disorders. You can tell BPD from other disorders. Something of its etiology, both environmental, often having to do with childhood adversity, and biological is known. It runs in families, and it has a complex but increasingly known course, which I will talk about today. Now, BPD is now recognized as a common disorder. Prior to this year, we thought that about 2% of American adults met criteria for BPD, and that it was about as common as bipolar 1 disorder and more common than schizophrenia. But a recent study by Bridget Grant, using a sample of about 34,000 Americans, found that almost 6% of Americans meet criteria for BPD. I suppose this study could be criticized, although it had every single methodologic bell and whistle on it. Now, let's talk about the continuum of borderline psychopathology, a continuum that I think we often don't realize is there, and I certainly took me a while to realize it, too. Some people with BPD recover spontaneously and are never patients. These are people with very mild cases of BPD. Some use non-intensive outpatient treatment and are never hospitalized. I would say these are moderately severe cases of BPD. But others become severely ill and use large amounts of mental health services, including repeated inpatient stays. And these are the severely ill patients who most of us got help from when we were training. These are the people we remember. And the problem with remembering this, if you're not a longitudinal researcher, is you remember the one or two patients who frightened the life out of you or made you overwhelmed in some other way, and you forget the many people at your facility who you never saw again because they actually got better. And a study like this is not just about the people who don't get better, but the many who do. Now, the latter group has defined BPD for generations of clinicians, and until very recently, most research studies have focused on inpatient-level patients, as does this current study. Now, this is the McLean Study of Adult Development, or MSAD. This was the first NIMH-funded prospective study of the longitudinal course of BPD. And we began with 362 McLean inpatients assessed at baseline. And let me explain that this study was in the early 1990s when it began. And within the first month of the study, our length of stay went from about 30 days to about 5 days. These are not wealthy people. About half of McLean patients are Medicare patients, and about half have private insurance. And this sample went across all sociologic levels of our society. So any ideas from the Bell Jar and other pieces of literature about McLean being a fabulous place with fabulous buildings and assorted other things, it's not true. We're sort of shabby chic, and we're heading to even more shabby times. So far, we have 5 waves of blind follow-up that are complete, 2, 4, 6, 8, and 10 years. Our 12-year wave is 99% complete. There are still two people we're looking for. The 14-year wave is actually now over about 80% complete, and our 16-year wave began in July of this year. Now, our subjects were almost 300 patients meeting DIBR and DSM-3R criteria for BPD, and I'll tell you what the DIBR criteria mean in a moment. And 72 access to comparison subjects meeting DSM-3R criteria for another personality disorder, but neither study criteria set for BPD. I just want to say that at baseline, most of the patients did not have a good clinical diagnosis on access 2. And these patients, the group, people in each of these groups are very similar. They tended to be young, impulsive, unhappy, to have made a suicide threat or attempt, and they could be verbally aggressive while they were in the hospital. And so I'm pleased to say that one of the findings I don't report, but is true, is that none of our Access to comparison subjects overall this time has developed BPD, so our initial diagnostic screening really pulled the groups apart well, and this has been proven over time. Now let's talk about the DIBR. The DIBR is the Revised Diagnostic Interview for Borderlines, which is an instrument I revised from John Gunderson's original DIB. And it has four sectors of psychopathology, which we feel patients should display all four sectors. The problem with the DSM criteria, as I'm sure you've all noticed, is not only that there are hundreds of combinations of ways people can meet them, but people can specialize to the point where they can have affective and interpersonal symptoms, for example, and have no forms of impulsivity. That's not the way this instrument goes. We require that people have dysphoric affect, typically of a chronic nature, that they have disturbed cognition, and we count three different levels: odd thinking, unusual perceptual experiences, paranoia, and quasi-psychotic thought, impulsive behaviors, and we particularly require that people have a history of self-mutilation and or suicide threats or attempts, and troubled relationships. And here, rather than the two items in the DSM, we have nine summary statements or symptoms that we follow. So it's a more complicated instrument. You not only have to have these four sectors, as you can see, but we also, it's a dimensional measure as well. And this results in a somewhat smaller and more homogeneous group of patients than the DSM system. And what's interesting is I've moved from inpatient studies to outpatient studies, studies of symptomatic volunteers. Many people in the community who come in as symptomatic volunteers do meet these criteria. And these more mild cases of BPD are exactly the same in terms of their BPD-ness, but they have less comorbidity and they function better psychosocially. So this is not just a specialty diagnosis for inpatients. This is, I think, a core way of looking at BPD in a way that's superior to what we have in the DSM system. Now let's talk about earlier studies of the course of borderline personality disorder. At the time I began this study, there were 17 small-scale prospective studies of the short-term course of BPD, and in general these studies were taken to mean their results that patients with BPD do poorly in the short run, which is sort of discouraging to a graduate student. And then there were four large-scale follow-back studies of the long-term course of BPD, and they typically, the results were taken to mean that patients with BPD do substantially better in the long run. Now, what is a follow-back study? A follow-back study means, in these cases, that these were large institutions. People went to the medical records rooms and basically asked to see all the charts of people with something that sort of was in the borderline realm. They called through, they made a diagnosis based on chart material, and then called people up on the phone typically and interviewed them or sent them self-reports. So it's not following a life forward, it's going backwards. Now the limitations of earlier studies were that they tended to use chart review or clinical interviews to diagnose BPD. And as we all know, our brilliant diagnoses may not always be agreed upon by others, and that's why researchers use semi-structured diagnostic interviews, which may sound so tedious and boring to you that you can barely believe I'm speaking about it. But the reality is, it's not a bad way, even in clinical practice, to diagnose people because it forces you over the criteria in the exact same way, one clinician to the next. These studies often had no comparison group or the use of less than optimal comparison subjects, such as people with schizophrenia, a disorder that BPD was seen to border in maybe 20, 30 years ago, but is no longer seen as a near neighbor disorder. They tended also to rely on quite small size samples with high attrition rates, and these high attrition rates probably were due to the fact that almost all of these earlier studies were not funded by government agencies. They were undertaken almost by investigators themselves or institutions self-supporting these studies. Now, they also tended to collect only very basic data at baseline and follow-up. Some only had three or four variables, for example. They typically only had one post-baseline reassessment. So, okay, this is this time and now another time. Non-blind post-baseline assessments, which actually affects things because if you know that all the patients are borderline and you're studying them, whatever your bias is, you may well see people as doing better than they are or less well. And variable numbers of years of follow-up in the same study. The best of these studies, in my mind, Tom Aglashian's Chestnut Lodge study. As a graduate student, of course, you notice all these details that later on you would never notice. But I did notice that his follow-up time was anywhere from the people who had been discharged from the Chestnut Lodge, anywhere from 2 to 32 years prior to the assessment. So that sort of messes things up a little teeny bit. Now let's talk about subject retention over time. 92% of surviving patients with BPD are still participating. And contrary to all the information about all the downsides of BPD, how difficult these people are, how frightening they can be, they also are remarkably loyal. They have no trouble saying they don't want to participate in a study initially. But once they've given their consent, they are very loyal. And in fact, we send out a letter the month before their interview, and we interview them every 2 years. And people often call up sort of agitated, like, 6 weeks later and say, oh, did I miss my turn? Is there still a place for me in the study? I also have been blessed with excellent research assistants. And another thing that I think is core to doing this kind of research is I've left the same voicemail message for 16 years on my phone. So when they call in, they typically get me or they get my voicemail. And they really sort of feel like it's organized around one person. And often when I'm in my office and they call in for an appointment, we'll talk about how they've done. And some people are proud of how they've done, and other people are disappointed. And 85% of surviving Access II comparison subjects are also still participating. Now let's talk about the first piece of really good news, and that is that symptomatic remissions are common. Now our definition of remission is no longer meeting either criteria set for BPD, DIBAR, or DSM-3R for 2 years. It doesn't mean these symptoms disappear because we actually study 24 symptoms. But it means that they're substantially less sick. And by and large, people don't just go down and miss it by one. They go down dramatically. So a two-year follow-up, about 35% of the people met these criteria for remission. At 4 year, about 50%. At 6 year, about 69%. At 8 year, about 80%. At 10 year, about 82%. Overall, in 10 years, 88% of these people remit. Now, this remission level is much higher than people had predicted. In fact, people were wary of even using the term remission with BPD. This is about the remission rate you'd see in depression, probably in a much, much shorter period of time. Now let's look at time to first remission. About 40% of those who remit did so at the two-year follow-up. Another 22% at the four-year follow-up. Another 22% at the six-year follow-up. 13% at the an additional 13% at the eight-year follow-up. And finally, an additional 4% at the 10-year follow-up. And I think what you can take from this to take heart is that it's not something that either happens or it doesn't within 2 years. Your patient may well remit. Some people remit rapidly, some people remit more slowly, and long-term work with these patients is not a disappointing prospect. It doesn't have to be intense, and usually in our insurance environment it can't be intensive work, but I think sometimes one appointment a week for 10 years beats five appointments in 2 years because there also is far less regressive potential. Now, the duration of these remissions is also impressive. 86% had been remitted for at least 4 consecutive years, 66% for 6 consecutive years, 43% for 8 consecutive years, and the best group of all, about a quarter, for all 10 years of follow-up. And the same result is really reflected in the next slide, which is because these remissions are stable, we had less than 18% of people who had a recurrence. And a recurrence was defined as meeting the study criteria for BPD, both sets, after two for 2 years after meeting that criteria for remission in a previous follow-up period. And this is the flip side with mood disorders, for example. Mood disorders are much more rapid, remit much more rapidly, but they recur much more commonly. In Marty Keller's famous longitudinal study of depression, he found that over 90% of people with a history of depression have a remission. Now, we're going to study these people much longer over time, and I assume that this recurrence rate will go up, but I doubt it'll ever approach the 90% that one finds with mood disorders. Now, this is another very important piece of information. After 10 full years of follow-up with a very high retention rate and also the ability through the internet to check to see those people who are no longer in our study, and they're not that many, only 12 people or 4% have committed suicide. And the expected rate was 10%. And why are these differences with these other studies? Some may be methodological in terms of who was diagnosed as BPD. It can also be that we no longer expect these patients to participate in very intensive dynamic treatments that often address issues that are relevant to them. The most important things are to get them functioning, not to explore every widget and digit of their childhoods, which were oftentimes very difficult and at times just utterly not bearable. But this also should lead you clinically to have more confidence in dealing with these patients. Many patients with BPD say, I feel unsafe, they're put in the hospital. But being unsafe is not the same as being acutely suicidal. And I don't think this risk, while very unfortunate, the 4% of these people have died, is nowhere near the 10% that had been expected. Now let's talk about the model we use in my lab, the complex model of borderline psychopathology. We posit that a hyperbolic temperament is the outward face of the neurobiological dimensions that underlie borderline psychopathology. And after kindling of some kind, acute and temperamental symptoms develop. What's a hyperbolic temperament? I mentioned yesterday, I believe, that I think the core feature of BPD is not emotional dysregulation, but tremendous inner pain. Pain that is so intense it's hard to regulate. But that a hyperbolic temperament is basically a style, it may well be an inborn temperament, where when things happen to you, you can't just be stoic about it and be silent about it. You need to get other people to acknowledge it. And these patients don't have unusual requests of others, they're not very graceful in how they ask. If you ask someone, your doctor, may I have an extra appointment because I don't feel well, the therapist may well agree, but if you say you're a stupid blankety blank and are of absolutely no help, it just doesn't win friends and influence people. And some aspects of that are aspects of the hyperbolic temperament. And kindling can be something catastrophic, like date rape in college, but oftentimes it's simply, and unfortunately, something normative. Going to college, having one's first serious romantic relationship, something that puts a stress on the person. And it's also been my clinical experience that a lot of these patients are very angry at their parents for things they haven't done or have done, but they also sometimes, as they can't make the hurdles of young adulthood, college, life partner, friends, a job, turn to their parents and start to blame them as though it's their fault for their lack of achievement. And you might say, well, gee, you're not as empathic as somebody talking about PTSD. I may not be, but I think if you treat these people as though they have what they do have, a sense of agency, they're going to respond better to you, and they're actually going to do better over time. Now let's talk about acute symptoms. Acute symptoms are those symptoms of BPD that resolve relatively quickly. They're the best markers for the disorder. In your consultation room, when you first meet someone, they're the symptoms that will stick out. They're often the main reason for expensive forms of psychiatric care, such as inpatient stays, residential programs, and they're akin to the positive symptoms of schizophrenia. In other words, again, they're the dramatic symptoms that are somewhat pathognomonic for BPD. Temperamental symptoms, on the other hand, resolve relatively slowly. They're not specific to BPD. Many other patients have them, and probably a lot of us do as well. They are associated with ongoing psychosocial impairment, and they're akin to the negative symptoms of schizophrenia. what's left behind the positive symptoms or what underlies the positive symptoms. Now, examples of these types of symptoms, acute symptoms, would be self-mutilation, suicide efforts, quasi-psychotic thoughts. Temperamental symptoms would be angry feelings and acts, distrust and suspiciousness, and abandonment concerns. Now, let's look at a figure, time to remission of chronic anger and self-mutilation. The anger is in the blue, the self-mutilation is in the white. You can see they both go down dramatically over time. In fact, self-mutilation almost disappears. Anger goes down as well, but not as quickly, and it remains higher. So temperamental symptoms decline, but not as dramatically. And I think this is probably your clinical experience. Many patients stop harming themselves in the midst of a supportive therapy where they feel held, but they don't stop being angry as quickly. The exact same pattern is shown here, another figure, time to remission of a temperamental symptom, intolerance of aloneness, and suicide efforts, which in this case can be threats or attempts. Again, both go down dramatically over time. Again, suicidal efforts like self-mutilation almost disappear, but intolerance of aloneness remains a problem for some, even 10 years after their index admission. Now, the course of these 24 BPD symptoms, we use two different methods of defining acute and temperamental symptoms, and due to the wonders of math and symmetry, we found that 12 symptoms were found to be acute in nature and 12 symptoms were found to be temperamental in nature. And let's go over them, because I think this is a good way for you to look at symptoms clinically. The first area that we study is affective symptoms, and the only acute affective symptom was affective instability. In fact, the very lability of borderline patients is the most malleable in the quickest period of time. Cognitive symptoms that go down quite quickly are quasi-psychotic thought and serious identity disturbance. And I put that as a cognitive symptom because in my experience, the identities of borderline patients were often marred by very negative ideas. They're very likely to have overvalued ideas, and often people will say, I'm ugly, fat, stupid, mean, bad. Impulsive symptoms that go down quickly are substance abuse, promiscuity, and as we've seen, self-mutilation and suicide efforts. The interpersonal symptoms that are acute in nature are having stormy relationships, yelling, screaming, fighting, breaking up with your partner, parents, treaters. Devaluation, manipulation, and sadism, which simply means that when you're unhappy, you lose track of people's value, you maneuver them quite in the way that a child does, and you can be somewhat controlling if you're scared and upset. Being demanding and entitled, serious treatment regressions, and countertransference problems or special treatment relationships, where you either try to warmly reparent someone and then oftentimes exclude them from your life when they disappoint you, which is a common thing. So you can see that these are sort of the things that are written about patients that are discussed in inpatient back rooms in joking and not so funny terms oftentimes. But let's look at the temperamental symptoms because they don't receive as much attention because we don't tend to actually offer treatment for them. The affective symptoms that are temperamental in nature are depression, the feeling of depression, not an actual depression, feelings of helplessness, hopelessness, worthlessness, being angry, anxious, lonely, and empty. The cognitive symptoms that tend to hang on are odd thought, for example, overvalued ideas, which we've just talked about, or unusual perceptual experiences, for example, depersonalization. And non-delusional paranoia, many of these people are quite suspicious, and in some cases, given what they've gone through, their suspicion seems somewhat warranted. And in other cases, it doesn't. Impulsive symptoms that are temperamental in nature are all the other forms of impulsivity. For example, eating binges, spending sprees, reckless driving. Things that are more normative, not particularly pathognomonic or specific to BPD. And interpersonal symptoms that are temperamental, not being able to tolerate being alone, having abandonment, engulfment, and annihilation concerns of a serious sort, being counterdependent, and undue dependency and masochism. So how do we put this together synthetically. Symptoms that resolve the most rapidly are those that reflect core areas of impulsivity, for example, self-mutilation, suicide efforts, or active attempts to manage interpersonal difficulties. Fighting with people, being devaluative, manipulative, sadistic, you're actually in there relating to people. There's some energy and agency behind you. But the most stable symptoms are either affective symptoms that are somewhat chronic, angry, being angry, lonely, empty, or interpersonal symptoms reflecting abandonment and dependency issues, intolerance of aloneness, counterdependency problems. I think we all recognize these kind of interpersonal problems as problems that our patients who are doing much better have. And what I'd suggest is that we really do need to develop treatments for these specific problems, because they're the ones, I think, that interfere with people getting work. They're the ones, I think, that are more common in those borderline patients who end up on disability, which is a somewhat high percentage for inpatients. And they're things that our current evidence-based treatments don't address, but we do need specific treatments for them. Let's talk about psychosocial functioning. I'm always somewhat amazed that either studies don't address how people are functioning psychosocially, or it's just not considered as important. 79% of these patients with BPD attained or maintained, because some had it at baseline, good psychosocial functioning over the course of the 10 years of prospective follow-up. And how did we define this? We defined it much as we would with anyone in our personal life, as having at least one emotionally sustaining relationship with a friend or a romantic partner and not a relative, and both a good vocational performance and a sustained vocational history. You could work well and you did it over time. Now, both patients with BPD and access to comparison subjects improve psychosocially over time. However, the functioning of patients with BPD remains more impaired than that of comparison subjects, and you can see this. At baseline, there was a difference, and it continues at 10-year follow-up, although the borderline patients seem to be catching up. This result was not actually found in the CLIP study, where I think people were seen as somewhat more level in terms of their psychosocial impairment over time. Now let's talk about sectors of psychosocial functioning, because we all have a social and a vocational realm in our lives. And patients with BPD show steady improvement in the social realm. And this can be that they're so interpersonally affiliative. If one relationship doesn't work out, they get another one. Or if things don't work out with their parents, they'll go back and still try to make them better in some way. But they remain more impaired in the vocational realm, which obviously has tremendous financial consequences for our society and makes this disorder a public health problem. Now let's just look at work and intimacy. At baseline, people were more successful in terms of relationships and with work. They both improve over time, but work really remains much more impaired. It's been my clinical experience that these patients actually do quite well as students, but being a student is all about you. Being a worker is all about the team, and that can cause real problems for these patients, problems that might well be warded off with a lot of preparatory work as they move into work. Now let's talk about psychosocial functioning and remission from BPD. Not surprisingly, remitted patients with BPD are significantly more likely than non-remitted patients with BPD to have good overall psychosocial functioning. And you might say, well, this is obvious. But what you can see here graphically is both groups, about the same percent had good psychosocial functioning at baseline. But a 10-year follow-up, those who remitted, it's a much higher percent than those who hadn't remitted. Now you might say, well, it's all due to their remission. You know, I'm not so sure that that's the answer. It might be due to them having fewer comorbid disorders, but I actually started to do some research, and I don't have those results for you today, that shows that the people who do well psychosocially and those who don't are essentially different people. It's not just that they're weighed down by more illness. They actually have different facets and different areas of competence. And I think that's important for you to pay attention to. Not everything in terms of someone's functioning is due to their illness. It can in some ways be something about who they essentially are. And this too calls out for a new kind of treatment where we adaptively try to help people not become chronic patients, not go on disability. Going on disability is a very disheartening thing. People do perceive that in some ways they're going to have a different life, and definitely not the life they had planned to have. Now let's look at predictors of time to remission from borderline personality disorder. 7 factors were found to predict an earlier time to remission, and in fact, they not only predict time to remission, but in some ways the fact of remission. We'll go over these in detail, but just to go over them now. Younger age, in fact, being less than 26, having a good vocational record in the 2 years before entering the hospital, no history of childhood sexual abuse, no family history of substance abuse, having an absence of an anxious cluster personality disorder, you're not particularly avoidant or dependent, you're high in agreeableness, you're sort of a likable person, and low neuroticism, you're not overwhelmed by symptoms of depression, anxiety, anger. Now let's talk about the nature of these predictors. 4 of these factors are commonly assessed in clinical practice. We all note when we first meet a patient their demographics. How old are you? In terms of psychosocial functioning, we typically ask people, what have you been doing in terms of work or school recently? So we find out that they might or might not have good vocational function. Typically, in initial consultations in this day and age, we ask about adverse childhood events, and we would find out that that some of the patients would have no history of childhood sexual abuse, and in fact, even within patients, 40% of patients have no childhood history of sexual abuse, and we've studied this over time, and only 3 people who did not report this at baseline have reported that they have new memories that they were actually sexually abused, and another 3 people have said that their memories that they were abused were actually faulty in some way. So it's basically been a wash over time. We also tend to ask family history of psychiatric disorder, particularly when someone's being admitted to the hospital. And here it would be, what's important is that no one in their family, no first degree relative, had a drinking problem or a problem with drugs. Okay, let's talk about the nature of these predictors again. Now, 3 of these factors are commonly noticed but rarely discussed in clinical practice, and they're all aspects of temperament. We all notice our patient's temperament, but it's hard to know what to do with it. What's a good thing for borderline patients is the absence of anxious cluster personality disorders. In other words, the people who do better have low levels of shyness and undue dependency. They're higher in agreeableness, and they're not particularly argumentative or manipulative, and low neuroticism they're not typically feel inferior or ashamed. So in some ways, the more troublesome patients who seem more action-oriented may well have a good prognosis, and the very quiet patient who doesn't do very well psychosocially but isn't much of a problem to you may have a poorer prognosis overall, not so much just toward remission, but toward their overall full life. Now let's talk about psychiatric treatment. This was a treated sample. In terms of over the 10 years, mostly these people are treated in the community. They're not treated by specialists in BPD. They're treated by whomever they can find. Most of these people still live in New England, but people do live all over the U.S. and in other countries as well. And over 70% of patients with BPD are still in individual therapy and taking standing medications during all 5 follow-up periods. It doesn't mean with the same doctor, the same therapist, but a high percentage are still seeking outpatient care. But the good news in terms of insurance companies and how they view BPD is that the rate of psychiatric hospitalization declined from 79% at baseline who had a history of prior hospitalizations to 29% of these people being hospitalized at 10-year follow-up. The hospitalizations are fewer as well, and they tend to be much briefer. We no longer believe in emotional growth experiences, but it's a stabilization experience. We've also located our admission unit next to our parking lot, and one of our directors of admission a while ago, her first question to patients was, what are you doing here? And the second was always, what are you still doing here? So we're really trying to get people to move on out of the hospital. Now, one of the not-so-happy facts of treatment, which we discussed at length yesterday, Ken Silk, others, is that polypharmacy is very common in these patients. And as you can see, even a 10-year follow-up, over 30% of these people are on 3 or more standing meds, over 20% are on 4 or more standing meds, and over 5% are on 5 or more standing medications. This is not only enormously expensive because these are almost invariably not generics or old meds, they're the best and brightest and most expensive current meds. But polypharmacy has a lot of health consequences. No one knows if it changes people's metabolism, increases their appetite, or both. But there's absolutely no empirical evidence for its efficacy. As I mentioned yesterday, our group did the only study of monotherapy versus polypharmacy, and monotherapy was just as good as the polypharmacy. And it's associated with high rates of obesity. Among our subjects who haven't done so well, 30%, actually the whole overall sample, are now obese. They have a body mass index of 30 or more. And we found that this is associated, not surprisingly, with elevated rates of osteoarthritis, diabetes, hypertension, chronic back pain, urinary incontinence, GERD, and gallstones. And the average age of these subjects at 10 years is 36, and yet they're reporting ailments that would make more sense if they were 20, 25 years older. And I would say that if you want your patient to have a social life, urinary incontinence is not a great symptom or problem. And also, sadly enough, we still have enormous biases in our society against obesity. We have a young lawyer in the sample who is very good at her job, but because she's obese, she's not been able to become a partner. And in fact, they don't want the clients to see her, so they've located her office in the back of the suite so that basically nobody ever sees her. So again, just like putting people on disability is not necessarily a good idea, working with psychopharmacologists who are targeting each of the symptom areas with different meds as your patient is getting heavier and heavier, I think you have a right and, in fact, an obligation to speak up and try to talk about the need for a second opinion on this, because although these are done in a well-meaning way and often out of desperation, as you can see, the risk of suicide is actually not that high. 12 people out of 290 who are desperately ill inpatients is not that high. And these consequences are really terrible for people's health, their social functioning, their economic well-being, and also this weight is almost impossible to get off. And I think about 10 people have already had bypass surgery. And I think given the fact that a typical bypass surgery in Boston costs $30,000 to $40,000, you know, that's another thing that people have to put up with. Now let's just review our main findings, and then I'll open this to questions. Almost 90% of patients with BPD experience a remission of their BPD. It doesn't mean they're symptom-free, but when you have 24 symptoms, many of which we also have, it's not surprising that they don't all go away. Recurrences of BPD are relatively rare, and they don't just fluctuate up and down. Something bad usually happens. For example, the person starts abusing substances again, or one patient was assaulted by someone she worked with, somebody with a disability. The course of BPD, as I mentioned, is very different from that of mood disorders, where remission occurs much more rapidly, but recurrences are much more common. They are the rule. Another main finding is that BPD seems to be comprised of two types of symptoms, acute and temperamental symptoms. I think this is a good thing for you to look for in your patients. What are they struggling with, and are they still struggling with it in a year? Acute symptoms should go away faster, and the temperamental symptoms do require a different kind of treatment, perhaps more coaching, more work around helping people adapt to what may be an essential part of their nature. Other findings, almost 80% of patients with BPD attain good psychosocial functioning. Their social functioning is less impaired than their vocational functioning. Their remission status strongly influences psychosocial functioning, as does, I think, their temperament. Completed suicide is substantially less common than the expected 10%. And this may be due to more trauma-sensitive or supportive treatments that people are offering these patients. They don't have to feel so desperately that they're a disappointment to themselves and to their families. Prediction of time to remission is multifactorial in nature. No one thing is particularly predictive on its own, and it involves factors that we routinely assess in treatment or initial evaluation, such as age, and other factors, particularly aspects of temperament, that are not routinely assessed or thought about or addressed. Now, in conclusion, taken together, the results of this study suggest that the prognosis for most but not all patients with BPD is better than previously recognized. And I think we now have come to agree that this is a disorder with a power and dignity all of its own. And these patients, we should greet them not with dread and derision, but with real respect for the loyalty that they've held on to their pain as a sign of them being intriguingly people with a lot of integrity about what their life has been like. So thank you very much. Intelligence and physical attractiveness, are these associated with better outcome in the borderline patient? In Michael Stone's work from about 20 years ago, he did find that these things were associated. I'm not going to touch the issue of physical attractiveness with a 10-foot pole. Intelligence is not a predictive factor for remission, but in early work that we're doing with attaining good psychosocial functioning, defined not as I've done here, but as a good GAF, a GAF of 61 or higher, it actually is a predictor of a better psychosocial adaptation. What are annihilation concerns? Those are concerns that you will cease to exist if the person you're most dependent upon leaves you. At what point do you support disability? Well, I'm probably not the right person to ask. With one patient, for example, a very shy man, we battled around for 10 years on this issue, and he was still asking for disability, although he rose to a senior executive position in a major firm. And he asked about it, you know, much more weekly each time, and finally, he even said, oh, gosh, this is so boring. Do I have to keep asking about this? But he initially had presented in an intriguing manner. I sent him to some vocational program, and the guy running it called me, and he said, you know, your patient is so annoying. I felt so much like punching him in the face during this assessment because he actually said to me, are you paying me for this assessment? And he said he almost went berserk, but at what point would I support it? I would not support it as a way to get treatment, which is a common practice. I think the therapist's own financial incentives sometimes get in the way. I would support it if the person has other problems. For example, if they've got some cognitive issues of their own and there are limits to what they might attain. I have patients who have some cognitive limitations. They do work, they do have friends, but they also are on disability, a few of them, because they're never going to be able to earn enough to support themselves, but they do have somewhat of a life. But I wouldn't think that anybody who's been able to go through college and so on, that this is a great way to go, because once you get on SSI or SSDI in the U.S. system, when you go to get off it, they resist it because it's so much paperwork. It often turns into a permanent thing and something really to think about. Did the subjects get therapy over 10 years? They were often in treatment at each period. Whether they were actually consistently in treatment, we don't know. They got whatever they got. In Massachusetts, most psychotherapy is provided by doctoral-level psychologists and licensed social workers. So basically the folks in this room. You mentioned that BPD sufferers blame their parents at times. for their failures? Do you think this behavior is part of the pathology of the disorder? In other words, do BPD sufferers often need a lightning rod, parents, boyfriend, husband, et cetera, to carry their emotions? If so, do we need to question the notion of a dysfunctional environment as a prerequisite for the etiology of BPD? Well, I think that's, we're really talking about two things. One, the etiology of BPD, and I think we have etiologies. We don't have one etiology. Some people really do come from chaotic families where sexual abuse is part of the picture. Some people don't. Their parents might be depressed or self-involved in some way, but they're not bad people. They did their best, and they often are willing to do much better. So the etiology is complex. I do think there are genetic factors around people's essential natures, their temperaments. The second real issue is when people aren't able to move forward and they turn and they don't blame themselves, but they blame their parents. If it wasn't for you, I could have stayed in college. If it wasn't for you, I'd have that boyfriend. I think remaining calm, pointing out the reality that that might not be so, although the person is certainly disappointed and ashamed of themselves, is probably the best way to go, not getting into a fight with them over the truth of the matter, but not accepting responsibility for it either. What do you mean by treat people as though they have a sense of agency? Agency simply means, do they have a sense of effectiveness? Do they feel worthwhile, and do they take responsibility for their own behavior? Do borderline patients improve over time, even without therapy? Yes, the ones who've done the best often are the ones who are not in treatment. They can simply say, I don't need this anymore. And we've also seen some cases of people who weren't doing so well, who were in intensive treatments, and finally said, you know, there's something wrong with the way I respond to this treatment. It's toxic for me. Dropped all treatment and did much better. I don't think it was the treatment making them sick as much as they came to a conclusion they didn't want to be a chronic patient. They wanted to have a life. If a person never acknowledges that they had BPD and then goes into a remission, is there a recognition of the part they played in fractured relationships that occurred during their symptomatic period? I think going forward, it behooves us all to actually diagnose people with BPD if we think they have it. It's a good prognosis diagnosis. There are at least five evidence-based treatments for it in terms of psychosocial treatments. I think people deserve to learn what they have and to learn about it. And what people did in the past where they didn't diagnose BPD and they didn't provide people with information, I think was unfortunate. How does bypass surgery impact the borderline symptoms over time? Basically, I think BPD patients are often seen by medical providers when they're still sick with BPD and seen as not very good medical patients. It's been my experience, if they have an outward symptom of a physical disorder that a doctor responds to, well, a serious disorder, like obesity, they're actually pretty good patients, and they often calm down somewhat. So I think they're probably good candidates for this kind of surgery. In fact, we had one woman who was seen as not being a good candidate for the surgery. We interviewed her 4 years ago. And she said, I think this will be my last interview. I think I'm going to die of my obesity. And in fact, the next year when we sent out a letter, her mother wrote me and said she did die of complications of her obesity, and that no matter what they did, they couldn't convince someone to give her the surgery. Elements of good psychosocial functioning. Can you correlate good vocational functioning with good, I'm not sure what, functioning? Whoever wrote this, can you tell me what this word is? Yes. Academic. Good what?
Academic.
Again, these patients often do better as students than workers. It's a different set of skills. But in fact, probably the people who are at the very top in terms of academic performance do go on to a good vocational adjustment. Are there studies on treatments for BPD other than meds, shock therapy, acupuncture, etc.? I don't know of any studies on ECT. I do know of the effects. Oftentimes, as I talked about before, yesterday, I guess, that I think sometimes people are misjudge borderline patients as having a major depression when what they have is major unhappiness or major dysphoria. ECT was never meant for unhappiness. It doesn't provide a job or a boyfriend or a home. And in fact, it does have short-term memory effects more and more. This is a treatment meant for people with psychotic level depressions, elderly people who had never been depressed, and so on. We have a whole series of cases of young people in our study who've had ECT and have really suffered enough cognitive decline that they were unable to complete graduate degrees they were in and so on. So I don't think, unless the person really is truly treatment resistant for depression, they should ever have ECT. And I don't know of any studies about acupuncture. What do you do about trying to help someone get work if their income depends and their health insurance depends on SSIDI and Medicare? I think what we can all hope and pray for is that sometime in the near future we'll have universal health care in the United States and not have this tied to people's employment, so that people with psychiatric problems can work, can be successful, and not fear that they're going to be without treatment. I mean, this is a perfect setup for borderline patients' abandonment concerns. Why don't you go get that job? And by the way, I can't see you anymore because you don't have insurance anymore. This is simply ridiculous. And what is counterdependency? Counterdependency is a defense that most of us in this room use a lot. It means we give to other people what we would like to get from others. We're very helpful, we're very stoic, although we do get paid for it, but still, that's what counterdependency is. Are there any other questions? Well, if not, thank you very, very much.